Welcome to another Psych Matters podcast from the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists. Psych Matters is a series of discussions on training and practice issues facing trainees and fellows of the college and other important topics in mental health. In this episode of Psych Matters, we have Professor Rob Kaplan speaking about the fascinating history of psychiatry. Professor Kaplan is a forensic psychiatrist, lecturer, and speaker with positions at the University of New South Wales, Western Sydney University and Wollongong University. His fields of expertise are sleep and pain disorders, neuropsychiatry, and psychological aspects of physical disorders. He also holds the distinguished position of the chair of the RANZCP's Binational Section of Philosophy and the Humanities in Psychiatry.
History of psychiatry, of course, cannot be done in one or two lectures, so I'm not making any pretense that I'm going to cover everything in detail, but rather look at what I consider the high points and the things that I would like people just to bear in mind when they look at this topic. The history of psychiatry is in some ways quite unique in that of all the medical disciplines, it is the only one that goes back to the very beginning of hunter-gatherer society. And that's something that's not very often commented on. Hunter-gatherer society, tribes, groups, wanderers, whatever you want to call them, from the very start, always had what we would nowadays call a shaman. And the shaman was responsible for the mental health of the group, the well-being of the group of travelers. And they had to do things like predict when the next drought was coming, where the animals were, and of course, look after unwell individuals. Now, in those days, they did something we don't do much nowadays. To cure somebody, they went into a trance state and using their sweat, their saliva, even blood from their nose, they would anoint them, and this would produce a cure. So they were thoroughly holistic in their approach. And it's interesting from the point of view of us archaeologists that this is the first specialized role in human history. Not bad. So if we think about the fact that Australia has been populated by the Aboriginal people for 65,000 years, we can make as good a case as any for the fact that psychiatry started on the Australian continent. Not bad. All right, let's jump from there. As you know, hunter-gatherers became settled agricultural societies. The shaman figure became the witch doctor, the healer, the magician, the spiritualist, all of that sort of thing. And slowly but surely, the idea of the doctor, the physician, began to emerge. But it really started 2,000 years ago on the island of Kos with the so-called School of Hippocrates. In fact, we've got no evidence at all that somebody called Hippocrates existed, but we know his school was there for quite a lengthy period. And the School of Hippocrates gave us several important things which are with us to this day. The first thing is they swept aside all the existing stuff about gods and bad air and all this nonsense causing illnesses. They believed in a rational approach. If you had an illness, there had to be a physical cause for it. So in that sense, you can call them monists. The second thing they gave us was the Hippocratic Code or the Hippocratic Oath. And of course, we all take a variant of that when we qualify as doctors. It's been upgraded, of course. There's no penalty now for stealing your neighbor's slave or donkey, but the rest of it still applies very much to medicine. And the third thing, of course, is they were acute psychiatric observers. So the three psychiatric conditions from that School of Hippocrates that are still with us are hysteria, otherwise known then as the wandering womb, hypochondriasis, which means under the ribs, in other words, you're complaining of things in your belly, and melancholia, an excess of black bile. Well, they had to have some explanation, and that was as good as any that they came up with. So the School of Hippocrates really set medicine on its ethical and rational foundations. Now, I'm going to jump a long way, all the way through the Middle Ages to the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th century when the whole ball game really gets going. What happens? Well, it's the Enlightenment, and of course the big development of the Enlightenment is the French Revolution. And the French Revolution had all these ideas about liberating people, freeing mankind, and again, being rational, the role of the rational thinking. And out of this, as revolutions often do, came Philippe Pinel. And Philippe Pinel was the star guy of the time, and effectively, you can call him the father of psychiatry, the man who set psychiatry on the path that we still follow today. Pinel was a revolutionary, and you might have seen, those of you who've ever looked at history of psychiatry or any books on medicine, the famous painting of him liberating the prisoners at the Bastille. By the way, Pinel never went to the Bastille and undid the chains of the prisoners. That's just a nice urban myth. But he was in favor of that, and that was the approach that he fostered. Now, Pinel did several things that were very important. He basically said, we've got to stop treating insane people as we do prisoners, chucking them in the cell, locking them up, chaining them. We've got to treat them as decent human beings and who are treated properly. And he wasn't unique. Hapduke in America, in the UK, some people in America started the movement of what was called moral therapy. Now, we'll come back to that word moral, which is very interesting in psychiatry. But what moral therapy essentially meant was you took your patient and you put them in a good environment. If you had to lock them up, you did it in a place where they didn't feel like they were in a prison. And this changed the architecture of asylums, which you can still see in the old places, 19th century places today. They had to have good food. They needed a good environment. They needed what we would call occupational therapy. And this was quite revolutionary compared to the way psychiatric patients had been treated. The basis for this was what you could call environmentalism. In other words, the Pinel school believed that all conditions came from your environment. And they were really, this became a dominant ideology. Well, that was all fair and well. So Pinel did his thing, and his chief lieutenant, as you might say, the guy who succeeded him, was called Esquirol. Now, Esquirol, like most followers, tended to be more fanatic than the actual charismatic leader. So he was a very dogmatic environmentalist, and he gave us a wonderful term that sadly has gone out of use, monomania. At that stage, there was no distinction between any kind of madness or psychosis. What Esquirol did was hive off those people who had a fixed delusional belief, and we know plenty of those, but the rest of their cognition, their emotion was fine. In other words, today we would call them variants of paranoid personality disorder. Well, I think monomania is a lovely term, and I'm very sorry that it's been dumped. But to go back to this term moral, remember moral therapy. In those days, and in fact, right through the century, the term moral was used in psychiatry really as we would nowadays use perhaps personality. So the ultimate example of the use of the word moral was moral insanity. Does anybody want to take a shot at working out what moral insanity meant? Psychopath. So you can see how it was really based on an idea of your personality, your behavior, not being classical view of psychosis. Now, remember, Paris was the happening place in Europe. You had the French Revolution. It was bubbling with ideas. They learned how to make croissants, which was probably the most important thing from the revolution. And everybody was there. And you also had something that happened every century, every 100 years, a new psychiatric disorder. And what was the new psychiatric disorder? Well, it happened all around Europe, but Paris was the place where it was really notable. Well, and you'll realize why in a minute. Middle-aged men, even as young as 20, perhaps as old as 40 or 50, would suddenly become disinhibited. They'd become preoccupied with grandiose ideas. They'd start saying, I'm the new king of France, I'm the new pope, and they'd blow all their money. And this would go on for a while, and then they'd collapse into a horrifying dementia and die within a few months. What was this? We now call it GPI, generalized paresis of the insane, otherwise known as tertiary insanity, tertiary syphilis, or just neurosyphilis. Syphilis had been in Europe since Columbus came back in 1494. Why was this condition suddenly appearing? And the theory goes that the syphilis bug had mutated over time and suddenly was doing this new variation. So Paris is now full of cases of GPI. It's a new illness. What's causing it? And the Escurel school said, well, of course, it's all environmental. There can be no other explanation for it. And into this, we have one of psychiatry's great rebels, a guy called Jean-Laurent Jesse Bayle, B-A-Y-L-E. And Bayle was very interesting because he shows you, his trajectory shows you how psychiatry, medicine, disease, illness is always affected by the social and cultural environment. Because in Paris, in France at the time, the going thing was the revolution. Bayle and his family were royalists. This was not a safe way to be. You could get knocked off any time. So by definition, he was marginalized. And maybe because he was marginalized, he was more prone to look at things in a different way. And the interesting part about this little sort of story is you have exactly the same thing occurring a century or so later in the Soviet Union. Once communism came in, communism did not believe in individual therapy, in the rule of the individual. It was all the environment. So people who practiced psychoanalysis in Soviet Russia were marginalized. In fact, they could get thrown into prison camps, and they did. So it shows you how these things go around. What was Bayle's big claim to fame? He did not accept the environmental explanation for GPI, and he wrote his habilitation. That's the thesis doctors do to qualify finally on a number of autopsies he'd done on GPI patients. And in 1822, he presented it. And this is a very significant date for historians because it was the first time we had shown, anybody had shown the actual cause of a psychiatric illness. What did Bayle find? Chronic choriomeningitis, really bad in all these cases. In other words, GPI, which they didn't know anything about the syphilis organism, had an organic cause. Well, you've seen this in medicine. Some guy from the margin comes up with a new idea and everybody jumps on them from a dizzy height. This is very much the story of Thomas Kuhn's paradigm shifts. So yeah, Escurel and his hitmen jumped on poor old Bayle, and he kept trying for a while, but eventually he gave up, went off and became a librarian and disappeared from history. But Bayle was right. The organic model was soon to come into play. Now, remember I said psychiatry was developing at the start of the 19th century. Does everybody know where the word psychiatry comes from? Well, it didn't come from a revolutionary. It came from a guy on the other side, a Prussian doctor called Johann Reil, R-E-I-L. And he is the man, very progressive for his day, who said the name for what you guys do, that what we do, is psychiatry. And that made his name in history. What was happening, and this is something you see all over in the history of psychiatry, is the French couldn't move away from environmentalism. And by the middle of the century, the happening place for psychiatry was Germany, or what was to become Germany. Why did this happen? Well, the German part of Europe was the place where the Industrial Revolution was at full tilt. And the Industrial Revolution spat out the German dye industry. And the German dye industry meant you could now stain body tissues to examine them properly, as opposed to just chopping them and looking at them under a microscope, which doesn't get you very far. So you suddenly had medicine taking huge leaps forward. You had Rudolf Virchow, who came up with the cellular theory of medicine. You had Robert Koch, who came up with Koch postulates for diseases like tuberculosis and all that sort of thing. And the other thing that was helping medicine along is often forgotten about. It had been around for a while, but the hypodermic syringe started coming into general use. Now, why was this important? Because in the past, pharmaceuticals, as we knew, you know, you just drank from a bottle. You took a couple of spoonfuls, but nobody knew exactly how it was absorbed and how to make it effective. Once you could inject something, you could really give people effective treatments. Of course, you could also teach them how to be addicts, but that was to follow. So the Germans leapt ahead, and the Germans had something else in their psychiatry. They didn't want to only have asylums. What was the problem with asylums for research? They were full of chronic patients who were highly institutionalized, and you couldn't really learn anything new from them. So the Germans, because of their focus on education, had a lot of academic centers. And at the academic centers, they put psychiatric units, very much like we have general hospital psychiatry units. Now, these units would see patients straight away when they were admitted before they became chronic. They often weren't as unwell as the patients in the asylums. And they had academics around. So they were studied and examined in a scientific way. The problem was that every damn patient they saw, they chopped up afterwards and spent years looking at their brains, and it got them nowhere. They could not find any cause, even though they were convinced there was physical causes for all psychiatric illnesses. Now, this takes us to the end of the 19th century and the emergence of the great figure, the man who's defined psychiatry as it is today, Emil Kraepelin. Now, Kraepelin was devoted to doing psychiatry. His background was interesting. His brother was a zoologist, so he was very interested in classification. But he had a personal problem. He had poor eyesight. And for that reason, he couldn't spend his time, as everybody else was doing, peering down a microscope. So instead, he went to work for a German pioneer psychologist, Wilhelm Wundt, and he learnt a psychological approach, which was very much how to do research. So what did Kraepelin do? If you looked at psychiatric research at that stage, you could say it had a vertical approach. You took a patient at a particular time and said, look, what's wrong with them? Okay, they're hearing voices, they've got delusions, they're behaving in this sort of a way. What Kraepelin did was he turned it 90 degrees, horizontal. He started looking at what happened to these patients from the time they got admitted. How did he do this? Well, at any of the units that he worked, they had what he called a Zahl card, just German for basically a record card. And every possible detail of the patient was put on this card, and then they were followed up. Now, it's an interesting thing about how talent emerges in any discipline. Around 1856, 1857, possibly the three greatest figures in modern psychiatry all emerged within a year of each other, and two of them shared a birthday. So that was Emil Kraepelin, and the last two who shared a birthday separated by a year, Julius Wagner Jurek, who we'll talk about, and of course, Sigmund Freud.
I hope that you're enjoying this podcast. If you have a topic suggestion or would like to participate in a future episode of Psych Matters, we'd love to hear from you. Please contact us by email at psychmatters.feedback@ranzcp.org.
So what did you do if you were a sort of go-getting guy who did research and wanted your name to be known? You didn't publish in journals. That happened, but that wasn't the way to do it. You wrote textbooks, and the textbooks were renewed, new editions every few years. And Kraepelin got in on this act. He wrote a very successful textbook, and each edition, he would put his latest research. And between 1896 and 1906, he not hit the jackpot, but changed the face of psychiatry forever. Because with his research, he had come to two discoveries, that if you looked at psychotic patients, who up to that point were all seen as bits and pieces, nobody really knew how to break this up. And the one condition, he called dementia praecox. And dementia praecox consisted of catatonia, paranoia, and hebephrenia. Now, these were well-known categories, but he put them all in one basket. But the characteristic of dementia praecox, think of the name. Praecox means young adolescent. Dementia, well, you know what dementia is. So once these patients got the condition, it was a one-way path downward. They could not recover. They never got better, and they steadily broke down. Okay, so that was the one. What was the other category? The other category was what he called manic depressive psychosis. Now, this is a slightly weak side of his categorization, but manic depressive psychosis is pretty much what you imagine. It was a classic mood disorder, but in fact, he considered it closer to any psychotic disorder, but the distinction was that they got better between episodes. And that has lasted, that distinction has lasted 100 years. But it's over, because it's very important to understand that it doesn't work anymore. What else did Kraepelin do? This is something that's often forgotten. Every psychiatrist does it without thinking about it. What he did was give a hierarchy of conditions. Right at the top, organic psychosis, epilepsy, brain damage, GPI. You know, there was an obvious cause for what was happening. Secondly, the major psychoses, manic depression, dementia praecox. Thirdly, the monomanias, well, what we now call the delusional states. Fourth, the neuroses. And fifth, right at the bottom, personality disorders. What was the point of the hierarchy? If you had somebody who had, say, neurotic hysterical conversion, but they were psychotic, you didn't call them a neurotic condition, you called them level two, a major psychosis. So it's a bit like bridge. You trumped the things below. And we do this all the time, but we don't think about it. Okay, so Kraepelin is now the going man. He's the buzzword. He's the Elvis Presley of psychiatry at the time. And he's duly awarded every possible award, and he becomes known as the Pope of psychiatry. He is so prestigious. Do you know that to this day, the Germans who just worship him, that when they have Kraepelin conferences, they put an empty chair up on the stage to represent their man where he would be sitting. You can't get better fan worship than that. But look, dementia praecox is a pretty crappy term, and it's not very nice to be told your kid or your mother's got this condition. What happens next? The Swiss come into the picture. Eugen Bleuler was a different man to Kraepelin, but arguably just as great. Now, Bleuler was different in that he did not work in an academic environment at first. He always worked in institutions. He ended up in the famous Berg-Holsey Hospital in Zurich, and he attracted, gosh, so many high flyers to work for him. Of course, the most well-known is Carl Jung, but there were so many others. Hermann Rorschach, for example, just to mention another one. And Bleuler was influenced both by Kraepelin and for a while by Sigmund Freud. This was a new thing. And in 1908, he gave a famous lecture, which became his textbook in 1911, The Group of Schizophrenias. So there you have it, the Ur word in psychiatry, the one word that can only, that is always associated with our discipline, schizophrenia. What was the big deal? Well, firstly, schizophrenia is a lot nicer to be known as or to be called than dementia praecox. Secondly, Bleuler differed from Kraepelin in that he said some of them do get better and some of them have a much better prognosis. The third thing Bleuler did, which was not a good idea in retrospect, he came up with how do you diagnose this stuff. The four A's, ambivalence, autism, ambitendencies, I can't even remember the last one. Then all the stuff we normally think of schizophrenic, hallucinations, delusions, those were secondary symptoms. Why was this a problem? Because when it was taken over to America by Mayer and the Americans who were driven by psychoanalysis picked up on this, you could call anybody schizophrenic. They were such vaguely defined areas. So there was a, you know, it's the law of unintended consequences. Bleuler was a really superb guy, and his work was lasting. and he was a genuine humanist. He really gave an enormous amount to psychiatry. So now we are in the 20th century. Things are happening. Everybody's looking for causes of illnesses, not much luck, but one thing is starting to become clear. A lot of people, including the German school, starting to realize GPI is due to syphilis. Now we know this, but we can't prove it. Well, we can. In 1905, treponema pallidum is first seen on a microscope slide of a brain tissue, is first identified. And in 1915, they finally see treponema pallidum in the brain of GPI patients. The last thing, around 1910, the first proper treatment for syphilis. Who did it? Paul Ehrlich. And Ehrlich came up with something called Selvarsan 606. That was the 606th preparation he had tried. That's how meticulous he was. How was syphilis treated before? It was horrible. It was treated with mercury. And far more people were killed by mercury than ever died of the syphilis they had. So Ehrlich was a huge breakthrough. But there was one problem. It didn't work on GPI. I think it couldn't penetrate the blood-brain barrier. So now all these things are going on. And psychiatry in itself is changing. We are getting our professional self-respect back. So the first thing is you see this evolution. 100 years ago, or 100 years before that, we were called mad doctors. We then became alienists. Lovely name, but you know, it's kind of a bit weird. We're better suited for movies about zombies. And finally, in the 20th century, we said, stuff this, we are real doctors, we are psychiatrists. And all over the world, you see people leaving the institutions and working, setting up in private practice. And the first thing they found was it wasn't necessarily the public who needed them, it was the law. Because thanks to the McNaughton rules, it was a big issue when somebody had a capital crime. Are they sane or not? And this is really important because if McNaughton rules apply, you don't get your head chopped off or you don't get hanged. So psychiatrists really were establishing a public profile in the courts before they really had as much of a profile with the general public away from the institutions. Now, remember I said there was a third guy. Freud was starting to put out his ideas. But there was intense resistance in psychiatry, especially in German psychiatry, not least because, of course, Freud was a Jew. But they just said it was rubbish. It was disgusting to think that three-year-old kids could want to fall in love with their mother and kill their father. So what you see is almost by stealth, psychoanalysis creeps into psychiatry without being sort of declaring itself. Because people were interested. And they wanted to do it. But of course, with chronic psychiatric patients in asylums, there's no place for even basic analysis. So it didn't get very far. Two things happen. The first one is Julius Wagner Würereg. If you ever see a picture of him, he looks like he's escaped from a colony of woodcutters that had been locked up for their own protection. He's a very weird looking guy, but he was a brilliant psychiatrist. He was responsible for doing research that showed cretinism is due to thyroid deficiency. And you forget that cretinism was a huge problem in those days. But Wagner Würereg locked onto something that had been known since the time of the Greeks. What was this? That patients who had high fevers seemed to get better psychologically. So he said, right, we've got to figure out a way to do this to psychotic patients. And he started using tuberculin extract in 1903. No go. Doesn't work. There are too many side effects. He thinks, I've got to get something else. And he latches on, and this is after many years of research, to malaria. Because malaria is the quartan malaria is the best way of producing very high fevers and ones you can control with quinine. So in 1917, the height of the First World War, all hell is breaking loose. He gets a guy from Macedonia, gets brought into the hospital, and wonder of wonders, he's got malaria. So they can suck out some blood and he lines up a bunch of GPI patients, pumps them full of the blood, and half of them get cured. And this was the start of malariotherapy. Now, this made Wagner Jurek's name, and in 1928, he became the first and only psychiatrist to ever get the Nobel Prize. Why did it take so long? Because there was somebody on the committee in Sweden who said, I will not give the Nobel Prize to a man who infects a patient with malaria. But anyway, he gets it. By the way, do you know who else has got the Nobel Prize? Just let me clarify. Sigmund Freud never got the Nobel Prize. He got the Goethe Prize for literature. Moniz, the Portuguese neurologist who started psychosurgery, got the Nobel Prize, which possibly he shouldn't have got. And in any event, he wasn't a psychiatrist. And there's another guy who discovered the role of messenger RNA, and he was a neuroscientist. So the only psychiatrist who's ever hit the jackpot was Wagner Jurek. Now, malariotherapy spread around the world. This was marvelous. And it seems to be every century something happens in psychiatry that's revolutionary, because we'll come to this in a minute. Not only did he discover malariotherapy, but a new psychiatric illness appeared. But let's just finish off with malariotherapy. It spread around the world. People were so enthused, and it changed the way psychiatrists dealt with their patients. If you looked at the records of psychiatric hospitals, you'd see a one-line entry every 6 months by the psychiatrist doctor saying essentially, hey, the patient's still alive. Nothing else to say, nothing else to do. Once you got malariotherapy, you had to have psychiatrists sit down with the patient and say, listen, we're going to do these things to you. You've got to cooperate. This is what's going to happen. And the patient had to respond. In addition, you needed a team approach. You needed nurses, you needed pathologists, all of this. And it was a whole put psychiatric treatment on a new footing. When did malariotherapy come to Australia? 1925, Reg Ellery, who I wrote a book about, and was the first psychiatrist in Australia to have a royal commission looking into his work the year before, from which he was exonerated. And he was at Sunbury Hospital, which was way out of Melbourne then, but now is in the outskirts. And his supervisor, John Adey, said, listen, give this a go. It's the happening thing. What was Ellery's problem? Where do you get malaria in Melbourne? It's not a malaria town, is it? And then one day he gets a call. Hey, we've got a seaman who's just come in on a boat from the tropics. The man is cooking. So he rushes down to the harbour, sucks out the blood. He'd started off with 10 patients. By then, I don't know, four of them had died. He had six. He zaps them. And three out of six get better. Complete recovery. Unique moment. The first successful psychiatric treatment in Australia. And Ellery went on to write his MD thesis. He became the go-to man for malaria therapy, and he worked at Mont Park Hospital. And he made the most beautiful little movie of treating people with malaria therapy. And it's in the National Film and Sound Archive. I've got a copy, which I often show at conferences, because it's beautifully done. It's in great condition. It's got little titles they've put in. And you see all these people sitting there like this before the treatment, and then you see them giving the thing and the temperature charts, and then they all line up with their suits and their furs, happy, walking straight, no ataxia, walking towards the camera. The only movie, or the earliest movie we have of psychiatric treatment in Australia. Now, I'm going to end off with, remember my theory, every century psychiatry comes up with new stuff. What's the new illness? Anybody seen the movie with Robin Williams called Awakenings? Remember in 1919, you have the world Spanish flu epidemic. Killed 50 to 100 million people. No war's ever managed that. And by the way, what's happening to us now? Oh yes, we've got another pandemic. See what I mean? But beneath it was a new illness and people forgot about it, because this turned up in 1917 in the trenches. And the psychiatrist who discovered it was the great Constantine von Economo. And what happened to these patients? They went to sleep. They went into a sleep state. And when they recovered, they had all sorts of problems, neurological and psychiatric symptoms. And this became known, thanks to him, as encephalitis lethargica. And encephalitis lethargica spread around the world, but it was all hidden underneath the Spanish flu. So by the time encephalitis lethargica stopped, and it did stop, around 1925, 500,000 people had died. But more important, encephalitis lethargica was a very lethal illness. 40% of people who got it died. But of those who survived, they had three problems. One, they stayed in a permanent sleep state. Number two, they had Parkinson's. Between World War I and World War II, the commonest cause of Parkinson's, secondary Parkinsonism, was encephalitis lethargica. It's worth noticing that Hitler had it. But the third thing was most important. They had fantastic psychiatric changes. It affected a lot of kids and adolescents, and they called them Apaches because they became instant psychopaths. There's bizarre stories of boys of 14 who had been perfectly well-behaved turning around and murdering their mothers. They filled up the psych wards, and it was really the spur for child psychiatry because nobody's ever thought of institutionalizing and treating disturbed children before. And that led to all sorts of issues that have spun on. Now, as I said, what happened to encephalitis lethargica? It died. But we know from history that every 80 to 100 years, there's a new epidemic. Well, when was the last epidemic started? 1917. Where are we now? 100 years later. So if it turns up again, you heard it from me. And the interesting part is we still don't know what caused it. They thought it was the influenza virus. No, they thought it was a virus. They've never found one. And the latest theory is that it was an antigen-antibody reaction to streptococcal infection, but still not confirmed. So all of these things put psychiatry in a very interesting stage. We got our professional self-esteem. We were starting to discover the causes of illness, well, at least syphilis. And we were actually starting to treat patients. This was the basis for what lay ahead. And then came World War I, which turned everything upside down.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Psych Matters. Feel free to share it with others and keep an eye out for the next episode in this series, which will be released in 2 weeks. Psych Matters is produced by the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists.